Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. On the morning of New Year's Eve, 1957, Orville Gibson went missing. The farmer from Newbury had been the talk of the town after his elderly hired hand said Gibson had beat him. 3 months later, Gibson's body was pulled from the river. He was trussed up and bloated, but the cold water had kept his body remarkably well preserved. The prevailing wisdom at the time was that Gibson had been murdered by an angry mob of townspeople, had suffocated in the trunk of a car, and then was thrown into the Connecticut River. Two people were eventually charged in the murder after a local doctor said he'd seen them at Gibson's farm very early on the morning of his disappearance, but they were both acquitted. The case has hung over the town of Newbury for decades now, and it has occupied the mind of Stephen Martin. Martin was a young lawyer representing one of the accused, and now he's published a book outlining a new theory of the case, that Orville Gibson committed suicide and staged it to look like a murder to get back at the townspeople he felt were unfair to him. Stephen B. Martin joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Okay, glad to be here.
Steve, why would Orville Gibson commit suicide, and why would he stage it to look like a murder?
He was a very proud man, and he was very committed to his farm. That was his sole interest, it was in developing his farm. And he was very successful at it. His world came apart when, on Christmas Day, the hired man came to work with having had a little wine, and during the course of chores at night, he spilled two cans of milk, and the two of them had words over that, and in the process, Gibson struck him, and did quite a bit of physical damage to him. He was very upset to be charged with assaulting his hired man, and he was ordered into court. He'd never been into court before. He found it very difficult to handle his 60-cow herd without a hired man during the week. And life was very difficult for him during that period. And the morning that, the morning that he committed suicide, he was going to go see a lawyer up in St. Johnsbury to discuss his case, and he'd called the state's attorney for a continuance of his first hearing, which was granted. And instead of going to see the lawyer, He went down to the bridge, tied himself up, and rolled into the river.
Tell me a little bit more about why you think, rather than just committing suicide, he would have staged it to look like a murder. Because when he was found, his arms and legs were bound, and as I understand it, bound to each other, so he was sort of trussed up. That seems like a lot of effort to go to. Why would he want people to think he was murdered?
Out of anger and revenge, he wanted to show his revenge for the people who were accusing him of beating up his hired man. Of course, when the state trooper came, he maintained that he didn't beat him up. And right up to the time of his death, he took the position that the officer had taken the wrong stance on his case. And he was upset that the state's attorney had decided to charge him with this crime.
Steve, you were part of the team who defended one of the two men who were eventually charged with murder. The team that you were part of presented the idea that Gibson had committed suicide back when the case went to trial.
Yes.
How was it received then, this idea of suicide?
Well, here is the interesting feature of this case. On the day that he disappeared, Gibson's brother-in-law, Freeman Placey, he was called by Gibson's wife to come to the farm when she discovered that he was missing. And when he came, he went over to see Mrs. Gibson, and then he came over to the barn and immediately developed the vigilante theory. He pointed out to the police and the investigators that, look at, see the pail that was crushed? And look at the trail of silage leading from the barn to the roadway, and I bet if we go down to the bridge, we will find some silage down there. And sure enough, he took the police down to the bridge, which is about a half a mile away by walking across the field, and there was silage there. He immediately maintained to the police that this was a vigilante killing, and that's within an hour or two after Gibson disappeared. And, of course, his body wasn't found until 3 months later.
So when you brought the suicide theory to trial, did it seem like it was well-received?
Well, not by the newspapers. Both the Free Press and the Times Argus took the attitude, well, okay, maybe he could have tied himself up, but we don't believe it. By the time that the body was found, the idea of a vigilante theory was well ingrained, and everyone was taking that position. And then when the body actually was found, there was an autopsy taken at a funeral home there in Bradford by Dr. Woodruff, and he announced to the world that Gibson was dead before he went into the water. Well, I would agree that if that was so, that would be a strong, conclusive evidence that he was killed by vigilantes or killed by somebody. But the ironic part is that later on, Woodrow changed his mind and changed his opinion. Said no, he drowned. Now the other feature of this case, which wasn't brought out initially, was that the authorities went to see two eminent medical examiners, Dr. Ford in Boston and Dr. Spellman over in Philadelphia. And when those two doctors were shown the pictures, their automatic reaction was that it was suicide. And both of them took the attitude that the way they were tied, Only Gibson would have done that. They weren't tied in the fashion that vigilantes would do it.
His arms and feet, you mean?
Yeah. And I have been at a number of book signings since the book came out. And at one book signing, Rick Davis, who was Dick Davis's son, he demonstrated how Gibson tied himself up, and at other book signings, I've had my wife do it. It's very simple. It's very easy for someone to tie themselves up in the manner that Gibson did.
I'm talking with Stephen B. Martin. He's the author of Orville's Revenge, The Anatomy of a Suicide. He was a young lawyer working on the case of one of the defendants in this case in 1960. He represented Frank Carpenter. And you think, Steve, that basically this theory of the case that Orville Gibson had been murdered by an angry mob of townspeople just overtook everybody so much that they weren't even open to the possibilities of other theories, like the idea that Orville Gibson had committed suicide. Some people might say, though, the fact that you were so involved in this case in representing a defendant makes you a suspect source for an unbiased look at the case and what happened to Orville Gibson.
Sure, of course, I take a view. That's, I can understand that.
All of the relevant people in this case are dead now. Gibson, Welch and Carpenter, the two men who were put on trial. Eri Martin, the hired hand who started all of this, his beating started all of it. And you have had a successful career as a lawyer, then as a judge. You've had a long and storied career in Vermont. And yet this case still lingers for you. Why? Why not just let it go?
Truth. I think people should know what the truth was in this case.
So, Steve, what do you hope happens from your book now?
Well, I hope that people will read my book and people will consider the points that I make. And I would hope that they would arrive at the same conclusion that I have, that he committed suicide.
Well, and for young people, myself included, this case doesn't perhaps hold the same power that it did for a long time. This was a case that went national. People described it as a northern lynching. I mean, this was a huge case in its day. So you bringing this back up and having people read this, this is not just some small case. This was a murder that made headlines, and you're trying to set the record straight.
There you go. I couldn't have said it better.
Stephen B. Martin is the author of Orville's Revenge, The Anatomy of a Suicide. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you for having me.